Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
It's been a hell of a radio show to this point. Marilyn called in, 92-year-old Marilyn, in the first hour. Said she's just trying to live through the weekend. I love that. We had on John Papadakis, the singing linebacker, former USC player, and he told a story that made my eyes glassy about witnessing USC throttling Alabama in 1970. Sam Bam Cunningham on the field for USC, running wild, caused the desegregation of the SEC and the Alabama football program. USC beat him so good that Bear Bryant said, we're going to have to take black players here. Brought a tear to my eye, literally. Also, great interview with Brian Lindgren, the offensive coordinator at Oregon State. What was your highlight of the first 2 hours? Alabama, Adriana, your highlight of the first 2 hours. Judah Newby, your highlight of the first 2 hours.
I liked hearing John sing live for us. I think that was my highlight. And I also loved how he talked about his first date and how it was like La La Land.
Yeah.
Super cute.
Love that. I love that you pulled up the audio, and I got my phone started blowing up from people listening going, that needs to be your bumper music from now on. Jazz. Go jazz. He did sound like Tony Bennett. Judah Newby, your highlight in the first 2 hours.
It always will be Marilyn. Every time. She called when we talked about St. Helens a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then followed it up today. She is the best.
I love, too, that, like, she came on and she said, I said, what are you going to do this weekend? She says, I'm just trying to stay alive. Very next caller, what are you going to do this weekend? I need to cut my fingernails. My wife has popped in. Did you hear Marilyn earlier?
Briefly, yeah. I like that she sets the bar low. You know, just trying to stay alive. Shouldn't that be for all of us? Like, yeah, that should be our goal for everybody.
I think that's super important. I think, you know, somebody like Marilyn trying to do that. We do the two at two. I'm trying to stay alive as well. The two biggest things going on in sports, they start now.
The two at two.
Well, Major League Baseball remains a mess. We know that. I mean, I feel like I just keep banging on Major League Baseball, but come on. For crying out loud, you had an opportunity here. They have until Sunday, the Players Association, to approve the latest deal from the owners. I'm not optimistic they're going to get this done, but Rob Manfred essentially came out and he said, yes, this is going to get done. Promise you, it's going to happen. We're going to have baseball. But it's not just having baseball. Just having baseball is equivalent to the grocery store just being open. When I go into the grocery store, I want to know that they're going to have toilet paper. I want to know that they're going to have hand sanitizer. I want to know that they're going to have meat. Get your act together, baseball. Bottom line, baseball's got to figure this out. And I don't think there's anything that baseball could do at this point that is going to make us leave this summer feeling like baseball took a step forward, and that's really too bad. That's my first thing. My second thing in my 2 at 2 relates around Dr. Phil. I'm talking about Phil Knight. He's going to be a doctor. University of Oregon is going to give Phil Knight a doctorate degree. This is the greatest honor that they can give to him. Now, he's been nominated for this before, but the Board of Trustees and the University Senate finally came around and said, okay, Dr. Phil Knight, we'll go with that. I think Oregon long ago stopped apologizing for having Phil Knight as a booster. And now they have wrapped their arms around Phil Knight publicly in a way that I think is appropriate. Rob Mullins, the athletic director at Oregon, told me a year ago that if he was drafting in any kind of competition, he would draft Phil and Penny Knight first. I think that's appropriate. I think if we're looking at boosters from around the country, I think it's worth noting that T. Boone Pickens, the late T. Boone Pickens at Oklahoma State, would be high in that draft. Oklahoma has the Gaylord family. Michigan State has a lumber tycoon. Ohio State has Les Wexner, who owns Victoria's Secret and who was wrapped up in that whole Jeffrey Epstein thing. LSU has the Bernhard family. Wisconsin has the Cole family. Oregon having Phil Knight, I think it's appropriate that Oregon sort of acknowledges and embraces the fact that, hey, they've got a booster and they've got a donor that helps them pay the way. College sports empires, they do not build themselves. That's the bottom line. And that's my two at two. The two biggest things going on in the world of sports. Also going on in our household, our kids are scrambling around. Literally during the two at two, the little one came in here. She was asking a lot of questions. What's going on? What do they need, Anna?
They're resourceful. They know where to go for help.
What are they doing?
They're just chilling. They're doing some crafts and playing games.
I thought school was out.
Oh, school is out, but they still need to not have their brains go to mush. That's what I realized. Talked to some friends this morning that are like, yeah, we're doing school in the mornings until 10.
No.
I was like, oh,
give them a break.
We're on summer break right now.
Give the kids a break. Don't you think the kids need a break?
Yeah, maybe for a week or two, but I still think they need stimulation.
No, I think you need a break. I think summertime, I mean, look, part of school, I'm not talking about let them veg out in front of the TV, but like I remember my summers. It was me on my own. I was having to entertain myself. Parents today, I think parents today are guilty of trying to tap dance and entertain for their kids too much. I do not remember my mother sitting down to do crafts with me or sitting down and going, here's your math assignment. Or my mom, I don't even know if she knew what was going on in my math class.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically, she opened the door and she said, I'll call you for you at 5 p.m.
You weren't four. You're exaggerating that.
I was young.
Look,
rattlesnakes,
like,
and
we've spent 2.5 hours building like forts out of branches, and I had very little to do with the construction process. They played in mud. They essentially rolled in mud and built forts with branches for 2.5 hours this morning. So that was their it was outdoor school.
Do you think that we do too much for our kids these days? By we, I mean just parents in general.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I do. I think I was just having this conversation. I think that the whole helicopter parenting thing is real, and it's why we've raised a generation of kids that is paralyzed by indecision and anxiety, because they have, obviously, broad, wide, sweeping statement. But they just, you know, the studies show they're anxiety riddled because they don't have the ability to make decisions for themselves and understand that, hey, there's going to be consequences because their parents never allowed them to feel the impact of the consequence. It's like they were putting up the bumper lanes in the bowling alley until they were 12, right? And so
longer.
Yeah. And so
20.
Yeah. So yeah, right. 20. It's why you know. So it is. I think as parents now, like, your natural inclination is that you want to provide a better life for your kids than you had, but you also have to resist the urge to just give them everything that they want, like, to understand that saying no is okay and to hold firm to it. Otherwise, you just raise, like, spoiled brats who don't, you know, and I'm not perfect at that. Like, I give in all the time, right? But at least it's in the back of my head. I don't want to raise kids that have no resilience and no ability to make decisions for themselves.
My parents' house is located adjacent to what I could best be described as like a commercial nursery. Okay. It doesn't have like big gates around it or anything, but they sell like plants and trees. It's a commercial nursery. And I was told at a very young age not to wander into the nursery. My parents warned me. They said, don't wander into the nursery. So what do you do when you're like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old? You wander into the nursery. So I can remember going with my friend. We were not allowed to go in there on our bikes. And we went in there and we were about 12 years old. And we're in the middle of this nursery. And there's these giant pine trees with pine cones. And I picked up a rock on the ground, and I looked up into the tree, and I saw these giant pine cones up in the tree, and I said, watch this. And I threw this big rock way up into the branches, trying to knock a pine cone out. Mm-hmm. And the rock disappeared into the branches, and we were all looking up, and I could hear it as it was coming back down. It, like, thunk, thunk, was hitting things. Mm-hmm. So it redirected, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, this giant rock hit me right in the forehead.
Jeez, you could have lost an eye.
Right in the forehead. Oh, blood, man. All over my face, running down everywhere. My friend was horrified. Everything our parents told us about going into the nursery was true in that moment. Uh-huh. I went home on my bike, and now you're pedaling, right? So your heart's pumping blood.
Oh, boy.
I must have looked like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre when I came through the door, blood all over my shirt, my clothes. And my mom is like, what happened? And my friend says, we went into the nursery. Uh-huh. What do you think my mom said?
Well, I told you not to go into the nursery.
Yeah, she's a nurse. She's not reaching for a Band-Aid. She's not saying you need a suture. She goes, well, you went into the nursery, didn't you? We don't do that anymore.
Yeah, we do.
No, we don't.
But the point of your story there is your parents could tell you until they were blue in the face, don't go into the nursery. But I bet you stopped going into the nursery after that experience because you had to experience firsthand the consequence of what happened.
Here, a prime example. During one of the commercial breaks earlier in the show, you were out with the kids. You arrived back home. I could hear you. I walk into the garage to see, like, hey, I got a couple minutes. I asked Judah, I said, how many minutes do I have? He said, you got a couple minutes. I go into the garage. The garage door opens. You guys are coming in. Was she six now? 6 year old.
Yep. Just turned six. I know. Catch myself.
6 year old jumps out of the car. She's got no shoes on.
Yeah.
It's raining. The ground's wet. Mm-hmm. I see her take about four steps. She's about to hit the garage floor. Ladies and gentlemen, you all know what's going to happen because her feet are wet. The garage floor, we don't have it custom coated yet. I need to call Bach Custom Coatings and get him to coat it. She takes it one step onto that garage floor. And I'm just beginning to go, like, hey, don't run. Mm-hmm. And her feet go out from under her. She's now sideways in the air. She lands on her side, luckily not her head. And she begins to cry. Mm-hmm. And I rush to her. I feel horrible. And it's that feeling I'm talking about. My parents would have said, that's what happens when you run with wet feet. I don't think they would have felt as bad. Why do we assume sort of all this responsibility to put bubble around our kids? Like, there should have been part of me going, that's what happens when you run. You're six. Stop running on the...
Well, I think you can still have empathy and then maybe a conversation at a later moment. Like, hey, you know, when you ran today, like, maybe that's something to think about later. In the end, she's still six. But I think it's interesting, you know, with daughters especially, that the studies show that parents of daughters tell their daughters to be more careful, to be careful much more often than they ever tell sons to be careful. And they've made the correlation to why boys are better risk takers later in life. Mm. And the ramifications of that down the road. And so it's something that I'm like conscious of now. Like I find myself going to say, hey, be careful, you know, and issuing warnings, but I catch myself to say, well, why am I saying that? Like, do I really need to issue the warning right now?
So we need to tell them to go jump off a log, go, you know, like, because you're right. Because are you saying that if she were a 6 year old boy, that I'd be less inclined as she's going out to play to say, hey, be careful. And mm-hmm. I'd be more inclined to be, hey, have fun.
Right. Yeah, that's what the studies show. And then that leads to, you know, the current state of things still, where it's like there are more men as CEOs. There are more men who, you know, spearhead projects and things like that. That's just simply how things stand right now. So I just think that's interesting. I think that's a little thing. And the other thing that, you know, I've tried to catch myself in saying, too, is like, the whole perfectionism thing. Like, I've tried to eliminate the word perfect as praise.
Why?
Because, like, that's anxiety setting as well. Like, when they bring you an art project that they've created and you say, oh, that's perfect. Like, you think that's great. You're giving them positive feedback. And overall, like, that's not a bad thing, right? But if what you're essentially telling them is that they are to shoot for perfection, well, life isn't perfect. Life is highly imperfect. You fall. You make mistakes. Like, you got to relish and learn from the mistakes. And I'm just, for myself, trying to not use perfection as the standard. I emphasize more on, oh, looks like you worked really hard.
Yeah,
on
but
this.
Is that a is it a fine line where you or a slippery slope to going, hey, it's a, you know, a participation trophy mentality? Like, shouldn't our standards be at a certain level for these kids?
Of course, I want to have high standards. I want them to actually do their best, but I don't want them like thinking that unless they achieve perfection, they're less than. And so the thing that I want to emphasize is the detail that they put into the artwork, the amount of time they spent on it, the variety of colors they use, like to give feedback or praise in a much more meaningful way, in my opinion, than going, hey, that's perfect.
Couple of breaking news stories. Arizona State President Michael Crow has just come out. He is requiring that all students, employees, and visitors on campus at Arizona State wear face coverings. Also, the University of Houston has suspended all voluntary workouts after 6 symptomatic student athletes have now tested positive for coronavirus. We're going to talk about this and more coming up. All right, my wife and I are in studio here at the Home Studio, Alabama. Adriana and Judah are back downtown. We will do the Culligan Water Cooler Report in this segment. The University of Houston is suspending all voluntary workouts for their athletes after 6 student athletes tested positive for COVID-19. They were symptomatic. Michael Crow, the president at Arizona State, is requiring immediately that students, employees, and visitors wear face coverings at Arizona State. That is a big topic of debate, and it is the subject of our Culligan Water Cooler Report.
Welcome to the Culligan Water Cooler Report. If we're talking about it, they'll be talking about it. Brought to you by Culligan Water Company.
All right, Anna, you and I were out last night. We brought face masks.
Mm-hmm.
Sister's over here. She was watching the Gremlins. We went out. We just said, all right, let's go sit, hang out somewhere. We went to a place that had some outdoor seating. And I had my face mask in my hand. We did put it on when we walked into the restaurant. Then when they seated us outside, I did take the face mask off. The place was smart. They had these menus. Can you describe the menu?
It was like a scan and read menu. It was like the coolest thing because that's one of the big discussions right now. It's like, okay, how are they doing this? You come in and your hostess says, here is a placard with QR codes that you can point your phone at. And when you point your camera at it from your phone, it calls up the menu. And in this case, also a wine list.
All right. So the idea there is that you don't have to touch a menu.
Yeah. Oh, did I leave that part out?
Yeah. Well, you're focused on the wine list. Why was that important to you? You wanted people to know you were a wine drinker?
Overall, it was
kind of a snobby comment there.
It was just overall a glorious experience to be back at a restaurant and not having to cook dinner and having a conversation with you that wasn't interrupted 1,700 times.
I did enjoy it. They did space us out. I like that they said to us, we have to sit on the same side of the table, and then the next table had to sit on the other side of the table, so it was staggered. So there was probably 10 feet between us and the next person. That made me comfortable. The servers. How about the servers in the restaurants? Can I hear it today for all servers in all restaurants who are wearing face coverings? Because the wait staff, the bus people, the hostess, the people cooking, you're going in an 8-hour shift there where you're, you know, a lot of them are in long sleeves. At this place, mm-hmm. they had long sleeves on. I could, you know, and I was like, man, that is, what does it feel like when they take the mask off at the end of the day? Like, that's a sacrifice right there. So we were out. We wore the face coverings. We took them off at the table. Now we're seeing, you know, what is being called a second wave, but epidemiologists are saying, no, it's just the first wave, guys. And now we're seeing stories like this. Houston, University of Houston suspended workouts for players because they got six athletes that tested positive. Michael Crow at Arizona State saying, everybody wear a face mask. What needs to be said here?
Well, I mean, the CDC is releasing new guidelines again in its first press release since March about safely holding and attending events and gatherings, as well as precautions to take when going out. Basically, if you're going to be getting together with a bunch of people, whether you're outside or inside, they are recommending face coverings.
Does that mean if I'm out on a walk, I have to wear a face covering? Or does it just mean like, you know, all right, I yesterday, you didn't know this, but after the radio show yesterday, I drove over to Baskin Robbins with the girls and I wanted to get them an ice cream cone. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I told the girls, you guys stay here in the car. You're not coming in. I put on the face mask. The only face mask I had was the 6-year-old's face mask. So my ears were sticking out like I was Curious George. I mean, it literally like poked my ears out. And I go into this place and nobody else in there had a face mask on. None of the other people, none of the other customers. They're all looking at me like I'm a snob.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well,
should I be mad at that?
I don't know if you need to be mad at it. I don't know if you want to spend the energy to do that. But you saw, like, you know, in Southern California, like 100 people showed up in Orange County to testify to commissioners about how mad they are that they're being required to wear face masks. So
they should.
People are having very strong feelings about this. But the CDC is saying, hey, man, if you're going to be inside, you're increasing your risk of getting COVID. And, of course, this is an asymptomatic disease for many people, so you may just be part of the problem spreading.
But the athletes at Houston have symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
They have an outbreak.
Yeah.
I'm surprised Houston shut it down. Do you think Houston should have not shut the program down? We are going to have this virus is, there's no vaccine right now. There's mm-hmm. no cure.
Yeah.
Virus is not going away. Hey, it's summer. Virus, take the summer off. That's not happening. So you're going to have positive tests. Should these universities be shutting down? Or just saying, hey, we're expanding our testing, or the symptomatic athletes have to stay home?
Geez. I don't know.
What would you do?
God, I hate when he put me on the spot like this. I'm this whole time, I think, for myself and for our family, we've been erring more on the side of caution. Like, we just haven't had gatherings. We haven't been inside anywhere with large groups of people. And so, you know, I probably would have supported that decision. If I was in charge, I probably would have shut it down. But, you know.
I think they're trying to be safe. They're also mindful of the fact that they could get sued by student athletes who say, you didn't act in my best interest.
See, now that is an interesting question. Like, the liability factor, we're such a sue-happy, you know, country and culture. So that is the question, isn't it? Like, what kind of liability will entities face if they plow ahead knowing that certain people are testing positive, and especially if they're symptomatic, will there be claims of negligent and harm and, you know, lost wages because they allowed
of course there will.
Certain events to go on?
Of course there will. I think there's a shot that, you know, we have a big, you know, backlash. I also think there's a chance that a lot of the responsible college football programs are able to practice and kind of keep their players and teams in a bubble and their mm-hmm. support staff in a bubble. I'm skeptical. This is the big skepticism I have. I'm skeptical that we're going to be able to get 20,000 people in a stadium spaced out and not have problems. And then what happens? Like, to your point, if I go to the stadium, let's say I go as a media member.
Yeah.
I go to the stadium. I'm covering the game.
Right.
They're taking, you know, their protocol. I get sick because there's a big outbreak because some fan was let into the stadium. And, you know, while I was in the elevator going to the press box, I shared the elevator with somebody for a few minutes that, you know, was positive for COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
Should I be mad at Oregon or Oregon State? Like, hey, you didn't do a good job of keeping me safe. You invited me to the stadium. Like, I assume my own risk. I'm not a litigious person.
Yeah.
But I could see people getting, like, doing what you said. I could see people going, you know, I lost wages. I was on a ventilator. I could see that happening.
So maybe the next step is going to be any of these entities that are trying to hold events where there are a significant number of people, everybody's going to have to opt in. You're going to have to click, like, you're going to have to click on something that says that I will not sue you. I'm assuming my own risk by attending this event. Kind of thing.
Here's another one. I talked to the Oregonian sports editor this morning. Mm-hmm. I said, how are we covering the NBA in Orlando? They are going to have this bubble. The NBA is going to test players and family. But how is the Oregonian and how are other media entities covering? And the feedback they're getting from the NBA right now is that if you are going to send a media member to cover the NBA, you have to pay for the testing.
Oh.
The individual entities, the media entities, will have to pay for the testing in order to, and it will be significant cost. I think that you're going to see the league in NBA, the NBA league in Orlando start up with very few media covering this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a couple national media members, a couple of teams that maybe play deep in the playoffs will send somebody to cover the teams. But I think you're going to get a lot of remote coverage of the NBA.
Yeah, because when you think about it, like when you go to these sporting events, you know, I've been in that media room too. There's not a lot of empty seats to spare.
But like, a bunch of unhealthy people too.
What does that have to do with it?
It's not the healthiest bunch. All you have to do after a game is leave the press box with a group of writers. And if they have to walk up a rolling hill, everybody's huffing and puffing.
Oh my gosh.
Crying out loud.
What's that about?
Training camp for the writers.
Isn't that a little bit ironic that the writers covering sports, you're saying, are out of shape?
They're all sitting up there. It's not because, you don't go to the gym because you watch people work out. You get in shape. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we should have a training camp. I think, they have strength and conditioning coaches at Oregon and Oregon State. Employers should have a health and wellness coach. And be like, all right, Ken go. Nick Daschle, Canzano, let's go. James Crepia, the Oregonian, let's go. Got to get you in shape. Get you ready for the season. I remember when I was a younger media member covering Notre Dame football, Indiana basketball.
That's crazy.
In the Midwest.
Yeah.
I look up and down. I literally did this during a game. I look up and down press row. I'm in the Midwest. And all of these people were overweight, out of shape. Balding, and I was like, not me, not gonna happen to me. So I, you know, sometimes during the commercial breaks, what's on the ground right there? Can you tell the listeners?
Dumbbells, 30-pound dumbbells.
That's right. I'm working out in
Is that
here,
what
guys.
Those are called?
I don't know what you do on the commercial breaks, Judah Newbie, but I'm in here. I'm doing jumping jacks. I'm doing
burpees.
I'm doing some dumbbells.
So you should be doing it while you're on air. That's the next step up.
Is that to the right or the left of the box of milk duds?
There ain't no milk duds in here. There's a cup of coffee and some dumbbells.
So that is interesting that you'd think like sports writers being around athletes who are like the top of, peak performance would be sort of by osmosis inspired themselves to be in shape.
I am inspired.
Right?
I am.
Like it would accentuate the differences.
It's not even an inspiration thing. It's more of you don't want to embarrass yourself.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're looking at you, you're writing about them, you're saying, and I think there is part of you that's going like, hey, I got to be in competent shape here. And so I do find myself like, I said this at the beginning of the year because I felt like last year, ever since we had these little kids, I have felt like the priority has been the kids and I'm not doing as good a job of staying in shape. So I've done more bike riding. I've done more to get myself in shape. Now, at the beginning of this pandemic, I was crushing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What happened?
I was down like 15. I have flatlined right now. And I think most of it is because I just, like all of us, I fell into a groove. Mm-hmm. I need to get back outside. I need to get out in the sun and I need to get my heart rate up. That's simple.
Yeah.
And I also need the key for me. It's 8 p.m.
You mean when the kids go to sleep and
kids are down and I hear a voice. Hey, JC. Hey. And I go, I'm looking around the kitchen. I'm like, what is that? Somebody in the house? And I look over and it's the bag of Lay's potato chips. It's calling my name. 8 o'clock, 8:15 every night.
I guess that's my fault. For a long time, I didn't even buy that stuff.
That's not the problem. You should be able to buy whatever.
Our 6-year-old, for whatever reason, just loves Lay's potato chips.
She likes salt.
She'll eat them for breakfast before we're up.
She likes salt.
Disturbing.
I know a lot. One of our listeners told, after we were talking about this issue, tweeted at me and said that they put a lock on the cabinet.
Oh, yeah. A lot of parents do that.
Just lock that stuff down.
I know, like a lock on the liquor cabinet.
Can you get a lock and not give me the key?
Is that what you want me to do?
Would that be awesome?
You wanted me to post like really unflattering pictures of you on the inside cabinet doors so that they would be a reminder in case you felt the urge to snack.
Some people are motivated by positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
I am motivated by the fear of negative reinforcement. So if you want me to be in phenomenal shape, you can do two things. One, you could post a picture of me in my prime shape, 6% body fat, college, whatever, for less than that, like just ripped.
Uh-huh.
Or you could take a really unflattering picture or even Photoshop it, have like, you know, me not knowing you're taking a picture of me and post it in there. I open the cabinet and I see that. I am not going to grab the potato chips. I'm going to go, I'm not going to be that guy.
You also gave me permission once to just yell, "Hey, fatty!"
Right.
Don't do it. Once you start to enter the cabinet.
Hey, fatty! Who's going to eat a chip when you're being heckled by your spouse?
I haven't done that yet.
Who's going to do that?
Shown incredible restraint.
Yep, nobody's going to do that. That's who. This has been the Culligan Water Cooler Report. It's brought to you by our friends at Culligan of Oregon. I thank them for the support of this show. Leave it here. The Bald-Faced Truth continues. Pick them up during the last segment or so. It's a little inside baseball when it comes to reporting. One national college football writer tweeted out the news about the University of Houston suspending their voluntary on-campus workouts because six student athletes on campus had tested positive for coronavirus. But then I noticed that Brett McMurphy of the Stadium Network is the person who originally broke the story, had tweeted several minutes earlier the news, and then just a bunch of other people cut and pasted and stole it as their own, or maybe they called University of Houston and did the reporting, but McMurphy had it first, mm-hmm. Brett McMurphy. Anna, let's talk about that. The practice of everybody wants to be first.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to break news and be the expert.
Yeah.
Okay? You've got competing entities. What is protocol when somebody else breaks a story and you want to report it? And maybe there's a reluctance here by the two media entities because they're competitors to credit one or the other. It comes up with ESPN, comes up with Fox Sports, all the national entities, CBS Sports, comes up with the Oregonian, comes up with the Athletic. You want to be first, but what happens when you're second?
Traditionally, you don't. If you do report it, you credit the person who broke the story until or unless you're able to independently confirm it yourself and then report it as such. But I feel like things are changing with that. I mean, just with like the speed of news and Twitter and I don't know. I mean, that happens to you, I'm sure. Well,
sure,
you'll break a story and multiple outlets will just take the information as if they had also broken it and not cite you as the source. Are you careful not to do that with others?
I try not to, but sometimes it happens. Sometimes, look, you might be working on something anyway. You get it confirmed. Let's use an example. Two examples this week. Harry Glickman, Blazers founding father, passed away at the age of 96 on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's just say that I had been tipped off by somebody that Harry was in bad health. He may not have long.
Mm-hmm.
You're working to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else reports it first, or maybe the Blazers even announce it before you can confirm it. And then several minutes later, source tells you, hey, Harry has passed away.
Mm-hmm.
I do think you're within your right because a source that is a reliable source has told you Harry Glickman has passed away to report it.
Sure.
Source tells me Harry Glickman has passed away at the age of 96,
yeah.
Blazers founder, great man. You do that. But one of the other things that happens, like today was an example of this. I got tipped off that Oregon was giving an honorary doctorate to Phil Knight.
Yeah.
Okay? I got tipped off by a reliable source inside the university.
Yeah.
I don't think this is necessarily something that they were afraid would leak out, but I had it first.
Right.
I reported it. I haven't looked, but I venture to say that after I reported it, several others may have retweeted it. Several others may have followed up and asked Oregon and confirmed it themselves. But, you know, to me, it's not as important to be first as it is to have a relationship or a reputation of somebody who's working on the level. It just wouldn't be worth it to me to rip off somebody else's reporting.
Well, and it's not, it's definitely not as important to be first and wrong.
Well, yeah.
So I think one of the other aspects of crediting whoever broke the news, when you decide to report it yourself, is that how many times have we seen when people who break news are simply wrong? Like,
yeah.
You know,
so and you don't want to be wrong with somebody, like, let's just say, in the event that Harry Glickman had not passed away.
Right.
That's the cardinal sin, right?
Yes.
You've written and reported that somebody's dead and they're reading it.
Yes.
That and that's why you double and triple check it.
Yeah.
We used to say when I was first in starting in newspapers, you know, this is when before it was you had online news and the online element and the social media element has complicated this.
Oh, it's aggravated it to like the nth degree. It's...
Because you used to have just your 6 p.m. newscast, your 11, 5, 6, and 11.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it didn't happen in that window, you didn't report it then. You weren't reporting it till the next morning, maybe.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
In newspapers, we had the 10:30 deadline, 11 o'clock deadline, and we were always watching you guys on news to see like were they going to get the story.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't have it at 10 and 11, we would pump our fist.
Yeah.
And we were like, we got it. They don't.
Yeah.
We're going to break this tomorrow morning. They'll be chasing.
And now, you know, the broadcast entity may very well post it on purpose. After the newscast is over at 11:30,
or they may get it. They may get it during the newscast. You've seen that happen.
Oh yeah.
Speaking of which, University of Central Florida has now announced that three of their 60 returning football players have tested positive for coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
They've put the three in isolation. They have not shut down their workouts.
Okay.
Who's getting it right there? Houston or Central Florida?
I don't know anymore. I can't. I just can't. I can't. I don't know.
Judah Newby.
I'm exhausted by the COVID thing. I just can't.
You're what? You had too much COVID.
I just, yeah.
Judah Newby, who's got it right? Florida, Central Florida, or Houston?
I'm going to go with Central Florida. You know, I think abundance of caution is great, but look, if you're going to bring them back, it was inevitable that positive tests were going to happen. You should have a plan to be able to responsibly isolate, take care, and move forward. Otherwise, you should have never brought players back in the first place.
Yep. I think that positive tests are bound to happen.
Yeah.
And they're testing. Do you guys have an opinion on this? Do you think that we're this so-called second wave is more about the fact that we're testing more? Or is it that people are out and about more and not being careful? Or is it a combination?
It's definitely both. Definitely. I have no doubt.
Judah.
Yeah, it's no question it's both. The testing is increasing and people are congregating. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
I think based on what I've read, and I could be wrong, it's not really just a matter of that we're testing more and finding more cases. It's that the rate of infection among the tests is trending up again, whereas before it was trending down. Does that make sense? So it's like, whereas before, you know, a couple weeks ago, states where, you know, even though they didn't have as many tests as they are testing right now, the rate of infection among those who are being tested is
so
trending
still
up.
Higher. The rate of infection
trending
still
higher.
Trending higher.
Which is why, you know, we're pausing, you know, all the reopening phasing, right, from the governor.
Yep.
So that's unfortunate.
I got bad news for youth sports parents. I don't think this is going to bode well for youth sports seasons in the summer. I think that your teams are probably going to be allowed to do some stuff. I don't think these travel tournaments are going to happen the way that people hope. And I don't think like sort of interleague competition is going to happen as it has traditionally happened. And don't shoot the messenger here. I just kind of feel like that's the direction we're going. Alonzo's in Portland. He's called in. Alonzo, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just want to share a point with My grandfather coached at Oregon State football back at a similar time. When
1970s?
No, 42. He transplanted the Rose Bowl to Durham, North Carolina.
When they rode the train.
Yep, exactly. With my father and aunt. It was quite a different time, you know. Instead of the hoopla of the Eastern teams coming out to Hollywood, it was, you know, taking 7 days and traveling, and then having all the Los Angeles hoorahs, Walk of Famous stars. But anyway, my grandfather shared with me a time that, you know, you talk about great golfers and coaches, and everybody looks at not really all their success, and they don't dwell on their success and the awards, but it's the miss the putt or the he came short here or there. My grandfather had, and I think what you talked about earlier today with your coaches, you don't understand. These coaches are doing things on a humanity scale that's giving a hand up to these young players. And my grandfather...
And that's part of coaching. I mean, you're supposed to elevate people. You're supposed to... I mean, he was a little bit all over the place there. By the way, 1942, 28th Rose Bowl. Do you know why the game was played in North Carolina and not in Pasadena? Do you know?
No.
1942?
World War II?
What's going on?
It was, there was a, the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and there were fears that the Japanese would attack the West Coast during the Rose Bowl. And so they said, let's take the game east. And the story goes, Oregon State got on a train.
That's amazing.
Rode the train across the country in the 1942 Rose Bowl. Was held in Durham, North Carolina, and Oregon State beat Duke 20-16. Lon Steiner's team won that game 20-16, and 56,000 attended. First Rose Bowl for Oregon State, and that was the memory there. But you know, the caller was mainly talking to, I think the point he was trying to get to was about sort of how coaches elevate players and bring people. I think sports is always going to be a great unifier. I think if people let it be. Mm-hmm. It will be a unifier of people. It will cut across socioeconomic boundaries, race, religion. Hopefully, it'll we're seeing times now where female athletes are getting more opportunities, and you know, certainly women's basketball in college has become a bigger deal, and I think a lot of fun it's opened a lot of eyes, but in opportunities. But I think sports can be a unifier.
Absolutely, you know, and that's why I think our culture we're missing it so much. Just people are desperate for it. You know, they enjoy it as a diversion from daily life. And it's just not, how many people have you heard right now that are saying, oh my gosh, I'm so tired of seeing the reruns. Like I can only watch classic games many times.
I'll go back to what Mrs. Miller, the kindergarten teacher, says.
What'd she say?
There's no such thing as being bored. There's only boring people. Leave it here. We're going to talk about that baseball card collection, that million-dollar baseball card collection next. Well, apparently in March, James Michioni passed away in March, and he left quite a surprise for his relatives who went through his possessions. He had, Uncle Jimmy had a collection of more than 1,000 vintage baseball cards. People started looking through them, his family did, and found there was a signed Babe Ruth baseball card from 1933 that's worth more than $100,000 by itself. Whoa. Apparently, Uncle Jimmy had 6 of those cards.
Huh.
All signed by Babe Ruth. He also had a signed Lou Gehrig card from a 1933 set, Jimmy Fox. Experts say that is one of the most incredible finds in the history of the hobby. The entire collection has been authenticated and graded by PSA. They're saying they're going to auction it off as 2,000 separate lots. The first 650 lots will go up for sale beginning on June 14th. And the cool thing is, nobody knew about this collection. Nobody knew about it. They're saying it's worth several million dollars. What are you collecting that might be worth something someday? You got a collection?
That might be worth something. Yeah, I was like, all right. What am I collecting? I'm collecting wrinkles and headaches. That's what I'm collecting.
All right, let's start with air. Alabama Adriana, what are you collecting?
I collect ticket stubs from shows that I go to, but I don't know that they will add any value later on. I think that they'll just have a lot of memories for me.
I think we have to start with, like, what's the purpose of a collection? And I think it should be stuff that is personal to you, stuff, mementos, things that, you know, that's one way to collect. There's another way to collect is, like, from an investment standpoint. Looked like Uncle Jimmy had investment on his mind.
How did Uncle Jimmy keep that a secret until, like, after his death?
Apparently he was hanging out with Babe Ruth. Back in the day.
How could you hold on to those for so long and not let anybody know in your family and let them be surprised by it?
Babe Ruth, apparently in the collection, he lived near New York for 100 years. So my grandfather used to say this to me. I'd be at Yankee Stadium to cover a game, and I'd call him, and he'd say, oh, I was there. I saw Garrett hit a home run there over the right field fence, and it would just blow my mind, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in this story, apparently Uncle Jimmy went to games that Babe Ruth played in, and he had pins from the games. He had programs from the games. Pretty cool. Judah, yeah. What are you collecting?
I've just got about every birthday card or Christmas holiday card from my family or my late grandparents since I was a kid. So that's pretty meaningful.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it makes me feel good.
Most kids grab the money and toss them.
I don't even read the card.
All right. I want you to have a great weekend. Do what the caller earlier in the show said she was going to do. Stay alive this weekend.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.